Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. For 195 weeks, that's nearly 4 years, Tulsa food blogger Sasha Martin prepared a home menu from every country in the world while sharing her family's experiences and recipes on her Global Table Adventure blog. As the countries rolled by, her audience grew, so perhaps it was inevitable that a book would follow. But an editor's early questioning about why she would spend over 3 years on a project like this provoked a very different book than Martin and her editors expected. Life from Scratch, a memoir of food, family, and forgiveness, tells the story of how a savored meal was perhaps the most grounded and only grounded part of a tumultuous family life and childhood. Martin's story begins in Boston's Jamaica Plain, where her single mother's own cooking adventures were the glue of an otherwise desperate and poverty-filled childhood for Sasha and her brother that included stays in foster homes. Eventually, the mother decided that her children's life would be better with a guardian. Her brother's subsequent suicide led to a period of intense isolation and loss of connection, and cooking became a stabilizing force in her life. So it comes as no surprise that the table becomes the focus for a young woman building her own family, perhaps the first family she's truly ever had. The book shares her story, as well as 29 original recipes from her adventures in the global table adventure. Sasha Martin is a graduate of Wesleyan University and MFK Fisher Scholar at the Culinary Institute of America. Her work has been featured here on Studio Tulsa, as well as Bon Appetit, NPR, The Smithsonian, and The Huffington Post. Her new book, Life from Scratch, is published by National Geographic. She'll be signing it this evening at 7 o'clock at a BookSmart Tulsa event at the Retro Den at 1216 South Harvard. Sasha Martin, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. It's good to see you. I think last time we spoke, you were somewhere in the bees in your global table adventure.
So good to be back. Thanks, Rich.
As you write in the very first words of Life from Scratch, this book was going to be an easy book. It was going to be talking about global table adventures, but obviously something happened along the way. How did this become the memoir of your life in which you, it's a wonderfully honest book, but it must have been difficult to write.
Sure, it was really difficult to write. It kind of started that first week after signing my book deal with National Geographic. I was all set to write my happy-go-lucky memoir of cooking my way around the world. And then I had a phone call with my editor, and she challenged me. And she said, Sasha, this isn't really a normal thing to do, to be obsessively cooking a meal from every country, 195 of them, 4 years, Afghanistan to Zimbabwe. And she asked me, what's really going on with you? What is this all about? And I was sort of stunned. And so I put down my outline and went and did some introspective thinking and kept coming back to my childhood. The more I thought about what was going on, it was like this uneasy sense of just not feeling like I belonged. And I think cooking the world was my way of reaching out. And it's ironic because my mom used to always say there's no such thing as half family. But with all the challenges and sort of turmoil, being in and out of foster homes and things like that, that hadn't been something I really felt, that sense of belonging. So the memoir turned into my childhood story and that, and exploring the ways in which food and life, I don't know, all that journey.
Well, I have to tell you, given that it's a National Geographic book, I don't think I've ever seen a National Geographic book that sort of explores a person's story in the way that yours does. Was it a surprise to the editors when you came back with this story, which is really the story of your life, and it's a tough childhood filled with recipes that you sort of sprinkle along the way? Was it a surprise to them when you come back with this book?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I ended up throwing out my outline, again, a week or a month into it, and I remember feeling a little bit like I was tricked into writing my memoir, but they felt the same way, like, wow, this isn't the book we thought we were getting, but they were so excited. They thought it was a much better book because, you know, a lot of these food blog stories have been done, but when it's tied to that deeper narrative of the human condition and trying to find that sense of belonging, I think that is a very National Geographic story, actually, you know, and my life, I happen to go to 12 countries before the age of 19. So there is a lot of journey in that disconnect that I experienced and kind of always trying to find my way back home.
Yeah. What becomes very evident is that food was sort of a connector from a very early age. It was a connector with your mother. Mm-hmm. It was a connector with your guardian, even though it's really interesting the guardian wouldn't let you in the kitchen.
That's right. That's right. Well, so with my mom, it was really incredible because when I was writing my memoir, I never really had sat down and thought about my conditions as a child. And so I'm describing the way we lived, and I sort of had to stop typing and think, oh my gosh, I slept with my brother in the living room. That's not, you know, an ordinary existence for kids. And what was striking to me was that I had never thought twice about it.
And your mother was living off food stamps for mm-hmm. a while and got turned away from a grocery store that didn't accept it.
Mm-hmm.
A young child says, okay, well, this is normal, and then only thinking back later.
Yeah. Well, and part of her gift was, she was a really creative woman, and so she was always able to make life exciting, especially in the kitchen. That was where she shone. That was her artistic space. And so we'd go in there because the living room was our bedroom. It was the only place we could come, and we'd make these outrageous things that she would dream up or she would find somewhere at like an international festival. So one rainy day we made a German tree cake, which was 19 layers broiled painstakingly, you know, as a rainy day activity. And I think because she did those things, she taught me that there's a part in the book where I realized there's a real difference between poverty of resources and poverty of spirit. And I think that's why I never felt poor all those mm-hmm. years.
Now, food was a big part of your life when you were living with your mother for a time. And she comes from what, a Bulgarian-Italian?
Yeah. Hungarian-Italian.
Hungarian-Italian
yeah, yeah.
Background. So you're eating, you know, real Hungarian paprika on dishes and then, of course, wonderful Italian dishes where they're cooking from early morning till the evening.
That's right. That's right. Food, and I think that was something she was trying to create for us. You know, she was struggling in her own way to give us the best life we could have, but I didn't have a father growing up. And so she was pulling on that heritage that she had, trying to recreate it for us with our environment.
Yeah, but it was a tough existence. She was a single mother. She also believed in giving you a little freedom. As I was reading her story, it was like I'm thinking of all these stories that are showing up now about, you know, the free range mothering, and you were a free range child, I think,
yeah.
at an early age.
That's right, and it was at a time, unfortunately, where that wasn't really the thing that
it was still
done.
Isn't.
Yeah, it's tough, and you know it is a gray area, but I, you know, things like if she and my brother had an argument, you know, and he was in his pajamas and it was 9 o'clock at night and it was freezing cold out and he had no shoes on and he stormed out of the house and sat down on the curb and pouted. She'd let him, and she'd say, he'll come in when he cools off. Well, stuff like that doesn't fly with the Department of Social Services. So, yeah. I mean, it was just that's sort of one of the many things that caused the real troubles to begin.
And the book is dedicated to your brother, Michael, and this is probably one of the hardest things to write about. You were placed in foster care. There were some incidents in foster care, and there was an incident in a church situation where it's not exactly sure what happened, but it certainly had a profound effect on him. This manifests itself. It must have been tremendously difficult to write about.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, I would say that I spent the last year recovering from writing this book. The kinds of places I had to go to tell this story, I just really hadn't been to those places since they happened, because I think it's a very natural thing. And it still makes me emotional today, obviously. But it's a very natural thing when you go through trauma to shut it out. Mm-hmm. And it's just a way of self-preservation. And so I think I couldn't do that for the reader. The reader had to understand. And so I had to open those doors back up and examine what really happened here and make it real for the reader. And so, you know, I knew it was my duty as an author, but it was also extremely exhausting.
It's maybe your duty as an author, but really you're writing. The book was signed to talk about this global food adventure, and you ended up going places I'm sure you had no idea you were going to go into.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think, you know, I think some of that goes back to my editor's original question, like this obsession with cooking the world. I think some of that masked my initial, so I would say, like, all things that were very true, and that's how I start the book in the prologue, is that, you know, my daughter was 7 months old and she was starting out on solid foods, and I wanted her to experience international culture. I wanted my picky husband to broaden his horizons. I wanted to keep learning and satisfy some of my wanderlust. But that restlessness, that desperate sort of seeking home, even that idea of, like, now I have a 7-month-old daughter, I've lived with this new creature for 7 months, and all of a sudden I have a crisis of motherhood, which I'd never really experienced before, is given the cracked foundation I was raised on.
This is your first really true stable home.
yeah, and what am I going to give her? What does the world look like for her? And so it wasn't just about painting this beautiful world peace picture of the world with, like, let's experience all these foods and let's make it a beautiful thing. But it was also about me seeking desperately my grounding and my footing as a mother.
Now, I'm not sure exact age, probably, 10, 11, 12, you were taken in a guardianship from one of your mother's friends. Mm-hmm. And this, to me, was some of the most poignant part of the memoir, because here they did this, but they never really, it really was truly was a guardianship. Mm-hmm. We will raise you, but that's about it. It seemed pretty harsh. It must have been tough to deal with, because when you came of age, it was like, well, we'll send you to college, but that's it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think there were so many things, as you read through the story, there were so many challenges. I really feel for them because they took on grown kids, basically, right? Like you said, I was almost 11 years old, and we wanted nothing but to be with our mother, nothing but to be with her. And so here they are with this challenge of how do we fold them into our family? How do we make everything okay for these kids, and we wanted nothing to do with it. And it got worse when we moved overseas because of different things that happened in the story, and I feel like one thing after another, disconnected, and now in a place where I don't speak the language, I don't understand anybody, and just going tighter and tighter into my shell. I think one of the things I would say about writing this book that was a real gift was seeing through their eyes a little bit better and realizing, because, you know, when you're a teenager, you're just really angry. And that's what I think I show in the book, is all my anger. But I also, looking back, realized what a pain in the neck I was, because I was so emotional. And of course, through no fault of my own, but I made it really hard. So mm-hmm. I think it's like most things in life, it's not an easy problem to solve or to point fingers. I don't think I can do that. They did the best they could with what they were given.
And yet the Dumonts did show you this other side of life. You moved to Paris. You mm-hmm. visited many other countries, lived in Luxembourg for a while. You did get to see a whole different side of life.
Yeah, it was a tremendous opportunity. And that's what I'm saying, is that they were able to give me things that my mom could never give me. So here I have two totally different ways of being raised, and both were gifts in their own way. So, any summer camp I wanted to try, any activity, 12 countries again by the age of 19, it was tremendous, and it was a great distraction to that heartache I felt. And I think that's probably why they were doing it.
Yeah. Eventually you came back here to the United States to go to college. You went to the CIA mm-hmm. for a while. And as a part of an internship, that brought you to Tulsa.
That's right.
And your mother said something very poignant. By this time, you'd sort of, there was a horrible tragedy that we'll let people read in the book, and you really were cut off from your mother for some time. And during that guardianship time, that must have been very difficult. But eventually you sort of had a rapprochement, if you will, and got back together. And so she's driving with you to Tulsa. She says, I bet you'll never leave Tulsa. What was your first reaction when she said that?
Oh, my gosh. Like, it just gave me the chills. First of all, I came out of left field. And second of all, I thought, what are you talking about? Like, I'm here for 3 months. It's an internship. It's not going to be this permanent thing. So, but then here I am now. I think that was 2005, so 10 years later. So mm-hmm. maybe she's right.
My guest today is Sasha Martin, the blogger, A Global Table Adventure. Many people have read this, and we've seen information about this during the course of her having a weekly meal from all 190-plus nations around the world. Now she has a new memoir from National Geographic. It's titled Life from Scratch, A Memoir of Food, Family, and Forgiveness. It's much more than about food, but food does play this role. And you, throughout the book, as you're telling these stories, you're sharing recipes that sort of relate as all of these people are, you're relating through food. And of course, food has that great ability to bring people together. And when you can't speak to them about anything, you can give them a plate of food and say, that's a great way of saying I love you.
That's right. Yeah.
Give us a sense of the beginnings of Global Table Adventure. Your mother, once again, she nailed it on the head the first time she met your husband. She said, Mr. Picky, what are you going to do about Mr. Picky?
So starting the blog was, again, this crisis of motherhood. I was trying to figure out what to do. I have this new baby, 7 months old. I'm living in a new city, really, just for a few years. And I'm missing that international travel, and my husband being so picky with that. He'd never had a fresh spinach. He had no idea what an eggplant was. So here I am trying to figure out what to do with all this and feeling very restless. So that's when I got the idea. He had given me some spice jars over Christmas. And they had been sitting there for almost 2 months empty. And he knew, he gave them to me because he knew I was looking to start cooking again. And I got the idea that I could fill those spice jars with, you know, the flavors and experiences of all over the world. And I just got this vision of cooking the world. And so that's what I started to do. I mean, I did a little research and to see if it was even possible, because back then there really, there wasn't a lot of, available research out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would Google some of the more remote countries like Nauru in Oceania, or like a tiny country in Africa called Lesotho, and just see if I could find any recipes. And at the time, I found a little bit, but not too much. So I ended up using the library and going through the Tulsa Public Library and getting all sorts of great research there at the mm-hmm. beginning.
But really, this idea came sort of fully formed. I mean, it was not like, I'm going to try to make an international meal and see how it goes. It was like, from what you say in the book, it's like, I'm going to do this global table adventure. We're going to eat a meal from everywhere in the world.
Yeah. You know, I think I call myself a front row girl. Like, I really enjoy learning, and I've always been that way. I don't want you to whisper to me or pass me notes in class, you know, when I was in college. And so, yeah, I mean, to me, it was like, what can I do to – well, okay, here's part of it, is that I felt really strongly that there's a lot of cookbooks out there with like Chinese food or French food, all the big hitter countries, but there really wasn't anything celebrating the smaller countries. And if I started to try to decide which ones to choose, then all of a sudden I'd be playing favorites. And there was something in me that just wanted to treat everybody the same and celebrate everybody equally. And I'm sure that some psychologists could trace that to my childhood issues, but it turned out really great, you know?
And the first country out of the chute is Afghanistan. Now, what's Keith's reaction when you say, okay, we're going to have Afghanistan cuisine? Of course, the only reason we know about it is from what's happened over the last 15 years.
He and everybody, they all wanted to know, are you going to talk about the war? And, you know, especially in the blogging part of it, right? And I think so that was great that was the first country, because it very early on, it helped me set what is my philosophy? What am I trying to do here? And I realized I was not interested in any sort of debates about politics or war or, you know, any of this stuff. And that being that voice of good, because I think sometimes countries become known as their one issue. I mean, oftentimes in the media, like that's, you know, this country's known for, and I don't even want to repeat any of them because it bothers me so much. But I think that does a disservice to the millions of people, billions of people who are just trying to go about their day, feed their children, and have that common experience that we all have, which is we do want to provide for our loved ones, and we want them to feel safe and happy and well-fed. And so that, to me, that starting with Afghanistan really helped me formulate that philosophy.
Mm-hmm. But you were making an eggplant dish, uh-huh. which you earlier mentioned. This is something foreign to your husband.
Uh-huh.
And you're starting your child on this from the very beginning. And yet it went pretty well.
It went pretty well. I think the biggest challenge was eating with our hands. Nobody
so
had really done
that before. You're doing a communal pot.
Yep, yep. Uh-huh. But, you know, I think in the beginning he was a lot more resistant. You know, I would see my husband sniffing the food or squinting at it. And eventually, though, he moved from looking at it as an attack to more of an adventure. And so he would say, oh, I think I detect cinnamon in this rice. And
is that what
it is? So it became really fun. Yeah.
But so you started doing this blog. When did you realize you were onto something where people were going, wow, I'm checking out, you're hearing from total strangers and the like?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a few different phases with it. I think one thing that was really exciting on a personal level was when people would email me from countries. You know, I remember a girl, a college student from the Ivory Coast, emailing me and helping me figure out a recipe from where she lived, and somebody else emailing me and saying, thank you so much for trying food from, you know, Kazakhstan or just any of these lesser-known countries. And that really, to me, I thought, wow, not only am I getting to, like, the popular culture of people to try new recipes, but I'm doing what I wanted to, which was celebrating these people, and they're hearing about it, and they're feeling special. And that made me really happy.
Pretty soon, you as you're going through this alphabet, I mean, it becomes almost like a burden, almost, in a way, because you're doing so much. You're telling about, you're encapsulating the CIA or UN report of the country, you know, where you're telling about a little bit about the country, you're showing about the preparation, but you've discovered in the meantime a whole new Tulsa too, because I think you're facility was we're a meat and potatoes town, and pretty soon you found all these ethnic communities here.
Yeah, it's really funny when you think like, okay, I wanna expand my horizons and experience the world. The least I expected was to encounter right here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I think one of the gifts was that I decided early on not to mail order any ingredients. And so if I couldn't find it in Tulsa, I wasn't gonna make it. And that's when I started to realize how closed my mind had been to the Tulsa community. I mean, there's not only Nam Hai, which everybody knows for great Asian food, but there's Euromart now on Cherry Street, and there's the African Market a mile and a half from my house. And so some of it was less about Tulsa's limitations and more about my own. And not only that, I was running into people everywhere that were from these countries. It was the weirdest thing.
You had a salesman come to your door the week you're doing Bulgaria, from Bulgaria.
That's right. And my mom let him in. And I said, why'd you let this guy in? Well, he has this accent. I asked him where it was from. It's from Bulgaria. And so, yeah, I got great tips that week.
Very early on, this nearly came to an end before it ever got started in Angola. Tell us the story about Angola and batons de manioc.
Batons de manioc. So Angola has this really neat recipe where it's very traditional. You would grate cassava. It's also called manioc. It's also called yuca. You grate it and you put it in banana leaf packets and you steam it. Well, there's all these preparation warnings about soaking the cassava and steaming it for a really, really long time, like 6 hours. And so I did all these things. But what I missed in the instructions, which I would have received if I was cooking with Angolan women.
Yes, you said this is where I really need an Angolan grandmother to make this happen, right?
That's right. Is that I was grating the cassava, the woody center of the cassava. It's kind of like fibers. I was grating that right into my packets. And that has traces of cyanide in it. Now, they tell you that in America, there is no such thing. They remove it all through some sort of processing. But I will tell you, after what happened to my body, that I am almost certain that I ate enough to cause some damage. I mean, all the symptoms were the same.
And, of course, what happened was when you present this baton de manioc at the table, nobody's touching it.
That's right. That's right. And I decide, out of spite, that I will eat everybody's portions because I spent hours and hours making these things.
How long did it take?
Oh, gosh. I spent the whole day. I mean, I remember just sweating.
You said your knuckles were practically bleeding.
Yeah. I mean, and it's the kind of thing that I think one of the great lessons about cooking the world and looking at other cultures is that so much cooking is done in community and slowly over the course of a day, right? Whether you're making that or you're making homemade ravioli or empanadas, kind of remembering to slow down and cook in community. Because it would have gone a lot faster, it would have been a lot more fun, and I would not have probably really hurt myself the way I did.
Now, that's one of the things that, as you're telling the story, you tell a story about meeting the Italian side of the family and sharing this ravioli recipe in which, you know, you're with, I guess, maybe a great uncle or something like that, and he's showing you how to do this and saying watch, I guess watch as he does it. Mm-hmm. And then you share these wonderful recipes. And can you maybe share some of those recipes that really mean something from your life? You mentioned the German cake.
German tree cake. That's
German
right.
German tree.
Yeah. And that one to me, like I always go back to that one because I feel as though nobody needs a recipe this fancy or, I mean, it's ridiculous. 19 layers broiled. I mean, it takes basically 2 days to make. Nobody needs that, but to me, it's a metaphor of perseverance, right? You do it not because you have to, but because you need to. You just need to keep going. And I think that's what everybody's doing in the world, right? Like, we're trying to push through. But the other recipes that I love, definitely the homemade ravioli. I mean, that's one of the ones where he would spread it out on the whole table and put this thin paste of the filling. You know, it's not this one by one you fill him. He smears it all over the whole thing. And this guy was like, I think he lived till he was 106 or something. I mean, he lived forever. And he made these raviolis well into the end of his life. I mean, just amazing. And so my grandmother's stuffed artichokes were really wonderful, super easy. And that was a dish my mom liked to serve instead of popcorn watching movies. We would eat stuffed artichokes a lot because that eating one petal at a time was a very popcorn-like activity. So I don't know.
Now, as you were going through these 195 nations, was there ever a time where you said, okay, enough of this, I've done enough? Or was the fact that, you know, more and more people were finding this blog sort of just like pressure to keep going?
I think there was some pressure. I think a lot of it was pressure I put on myself. It did get really challenging in the earlier stages, I would say. It just was the A's and the B's and the C's took so long to get through. I mean, there were so many countries in each of those letters of the alphabet that it was hard to feel any momentum. But I would say, you know, definitely my readers kept me going. My husband and then my daughter, as she grew up, kept me going. She'd start asking, "What country is this, Mama?" as she learned to talk. Mm-hmm. And it became something that at some point, and I don't know when it happened, we just couldn't not do.
Mm-hmm. Now, the goal was to expose your daughter to all sorts of cuisines, to make your husband a little less picky. Did that happen?
I think so. I think, you know, my husband, he now wants to go out for sushi, which is a big deal. Because the first time he had it, he said, "Why is the rice cold?" I mean, you know. And then my daughter, too. I mean, she is so fascinating to watch. She loves to help me in the kitchen. She loves to know where food is from. She likes seeing. Sometimes I'll show her videos of kids in other countries eating food, and she really enjoys that. I found with her especially, if I could get her involved in the cooking process, she'd be so much more interested in trying the food. And that's how she came to try sushi for the first time. So I was busy, you know, I got all the rice out on the nori, and she started adding her favorite vegetables, 2 years old, mm-hmm. and she helps me roll it up, and I slice it, and I couldn't finish slicing it fast enough before she popped it in her mouth, and there she was a sushi convert, so.
Yeah. One of the things that's really interesting is that, you know, you went from this life where you were definitely a part of the kitchen, and then there's this whole middle section when you were with your guardians where that was just not allowed. And I found that really interesting because I thought most generations, most places, it's like the kitchen is the place where everyone's welcome. What was going on with that?
You know, it's hard to know exactly what somebody else is thinking, but I think my guardians believed so much in giving me the best education possible. They felt like anything else was a distraction, is what I would think. Again, that's my assumption. But going into the streets of Paris turned out to be a really great way for me to get a culinary education too, so I got it nonetheless. So I'm going through bakeries, boulangerie, fromagerie, and creperie, as I like to say, and just really soaking it all in. And in a way, that was even better because I was able to experience things that probably wouldn't have been cooked at home anyway.
My guest today is Sasha Martin. She's the blogger behind Global Table Adventure and the author of a new memoir, Life from Scratch, a memoir of food, family, and forgiveness. It's published by National Geographic Books. We wish you great success with the book. It's a really wonderful read. Sasha Martin, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Sasha Martin is the blogger behind Global Table Adventure and the author of Life from Scratch, a memoir of food, family, and forgiveness. It's published by National Geographic. She'll be signing her book this evening at 7 o'clock at a BookSmart Tulsa event at the Retro Den at 1216 South Harvard. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.